This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
We reserve the right for explicit language, but the algorithm reveals there is no such language in this episode. Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I am Mike Pesca. All the world's attention is on Pelosi. What could this unsanctioned, irresponsible, clearly destructive little jaunt mean? Is Pelosi a problem operating outside the bounds of decorum or law? Will Pelosi face consequences? Fox News recognized in its coverage that America needed answers.
Just an hour before his arraignment, we are learning new details about Paul Pelosi's behavior the night of his DUI arrest and how he tried to curry favor with the arriving officers.
Yes, Paul Pelosi, one of the many traveling Pelosis. She, via government transport, which engendered a military response, a massive military response, in fact, him crashing his Porsche into an SUV and being charged with having a 0.08 blood alcohol level. Drunk driving's bad. It's serious. But maybe not so serious as the agitation of a world superpower, a nuclear one at that. And remember, because what's going on here is that even Nancy Pelosi's biggest critics in the Senate applauded her. So Fox News was in a bind. Standing up to China, good, in the Fox worldview. All the Republican senators also agreed, good. But of course, we know forevermore, Pelosi bad. So what to do? We can still have a story of a bad Pelosi, just not necessarily Nancy. Shift the emphasis onto the spouse of a government official. Oh, and the currying of favor? Well, I will quote the Fox.com report on this. Pelosi, this is Paul, allegedly handed officers his driver's license and a 9/11 Foundation card when they asked for his ID, according to the documents. The 9/11 Foundation is a California Highway Patrol charity that supports officers and provides scholarships for their children. The implication being, I'm a good guy, I support the cops. By the way, that's the only reason why you carry around a California Highway Patrol charity card or a PBA card. So when you get pulled over by the cops, you show them your license in your wallet, but right next to it is this PBA, hey, I'm nice to the cops type card. The arraignment that Fox News was previewing all morning, and in fact, much of last night when they got the leaked documents about the California Highway Patrol card, it went like this, very detailed. You might want a pencil to follow along. Paul Pelosi's lawyer pled not guilty, and the next court date was set for August 23rd. But if you want a real date with the American legal system, down in Texas, everything's bigger, including the 400 PSA fire hose torrent of bullshit spewing from civil defendant Alex Jones. He's being sued by families of the children killed in Sandy Hook. Jones is engaged in what clearly is a legal strategy, as using the trial as a stage to advance his program, InfoWars. In fact, on InfoWars yesterday, Jones's show aired a segment alleging that the judge in this case was abetting a pedophile ring. The plaintiff's lawyers played a clip of that for Jones and the jury to see.
Judge Maya Gamble comes from CPS, who has been exposed for human trafficking and working with pedophiles.
When Jones complained, bah, the clip's only 5 seconds, there might have been a lot of interesting exculpatory language around what you just heard and the accompanying visual of the judge's face bathed in hellfire, the plaintiff's lawyer asked this, which elicited a fine response.
Does it matter? Is there anything before and after that that would make it great to show pictures of our judge on fire and telling the world she's involved in pedophile? Can you tell me the context that would occur before or after that makes that
great? Sorry.
Excuse me. Sorry.
I believe, if you're only wanting to go off 5 seconds, I believe the thing is, the judge is the fire burning Lady Liberty. It's not the judge. The judge is consuming freedom.
A jury whose time and attention is taken up by a proceeding usually identifies with a judge. The judge orients them, explains things to them, asks them if they need breaks. A jury, even if they're not so into the judge, and they usually are, and don't like the judge being insulted and defamed, but a jury definitely believes in its own wisdom, or at least diligence. But there were clips played of Jones insulting the jury, intimating that they were part of a conspiracy against him. Then there was a section of the trial where Judge Gamble asked witness questions written by jurors, and this came up.
Are you aware that this jury consists of 16 intelligent, fair-minded citizens who are not being improperly influenced in any way?
Yes, I don't think that you are operatives. I don't think that you are part of a false flag.
I've not even played for you the lengthy sections of Jones's testimony where he was caught lying about his finances, his use of email, and about when he actually corrected the record on Sandy Hook, if he corrected the record on Sandy Hook. Pretty much every assertion he made in his testimony was effectively called into question by counsel. Because, you know, this really isn't a trial. It's a sideshow so that the InfoWar crowd continues to cheer him on and keep him funded. The jury, in all likelihood, will find him liable for damages and maybe a lot of damages. Whatever that award is will be held up on appeal. Bafflingly, Jones's own appeal to his audience will probably continue on even stronger than before the trial. On the show today, well, I'll admit, what you just heard, took a little while, got there, lots of crazy clips to play, but I wanted to give you your money's worth. There shall be no spiel today, but it's fine. It's by design. It's because we got two scholars to talk about that Pelosi trip, the Nancy Pelosi trip. She is the person second in line to succeed the president, and she visited a country, China would say a territory, in a gesture that was enormously provocative. But was it needlessly provocative? We will discuss with USC's David Kang and the Eurasia Group's Neil Thomas up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan was framed and decried and applauded as an act of recklessness or fecklessness or bravery or something else. During the time, the Chinese military engaged in exercises around the island, which amounted to a blockade of its sea and airspace, the defense ministry said. Tangibly, you ready for this as a consequence? They have blocked fish and citrus fruit imports from Taiwan. But what will the real effects be, and how wise was this trip? Was it worth it? Was anything gained? Joining me now are two esteemed China and Taiwan watchers. Neil Thomas is senior China analyst at the Eurasia Group. Welcome to The Gist, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And David C. Kang is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. He also has an appointment to the business school. Just so you know, it's not just his expertise extends beyond just international relations. Professor Kang, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks for having me.
So, I'll frame this as many people have put forward this idea. I'll just quote a headline in a Thomas Friedman article. Pelosi's visit to Taiwan is utterly reckless. On a scale of 1 to 10, to orient me and our listeners, I'd like each of you to tell me where you stand in relation to that assertion, 0 being total disagreement and 10 being Friedman nailed it. Professor Kang, why don't you go first?
Well, I certainly don't think she should have gone. But in terms of recklessness, this was never going to start World War III, and it was never going to be nothing. So I don't agree that it was, you know, utterly reckless, but certainly I wouldn't have gone. But this was not a major crisis the way that it's been played up.
Okay, a quibble with the adverb. It was minorly reckless.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. And what do you think, Neil?
I think it's true that Pelosi going to Taiwan has increased cross-strait tension and has contributed to the risks of a military accident or confrontation in the Taiwan Strait. But fundamentally, it wasn't quite a provocation of enough magnitude to prompt Beijing to do anything utterly reckless itself in terms of attacking Taiwan or trying to confront Pelosi's plane or confront other U.S. military in the region. So, I mean, the question of whether she should have gone or not, I think it certainly, has these negative effects. But I think we also have to look at Taiwan itself, the government, and a lot of Taiwanese people gave her a very warm welcome. So there's certainly, the sense I got was that the level of alarm in Taipei was actually less than the level of alarm in DC. So I'd agree that it's certainly something that contributes to risks, but that the risks of this particular action were not going to blow up in the short term. Although we've got to look to the longer term. Beijing's reaction is going to play out in days, months, years, from what it sees as a kind of a move by the U.S. to support Taiwan in a much more tangible way.
Yeah, I noted that many Taiwanese officials, the actual officials in power now, welcome them. If you heard from people who are high up in Taiwanese officialdom society positions, Enoch Wu, founder of the Taipei-based security and defense think tank Forward Alliance, who used to be on the Security Council, said the fear of Chinese retaliation should not dictate engagement between partners being the United States and Taipei. It would be a very positive step forward, said Vincent Chow, who was essentially Taiwan's ambassador to the United States. So if the Taiwanese like it and they would bear the brunt of a Chinese invasion, I was thinking to myself, should we not defer to their opinions? Is that a reasonable read, Professor Kang?
There have been unofficial, official, it's hard to say because we have never decided what that line is between an official, U.S. government visit, right? So these things go on all the time. She's the highest ranking official in, 25 years or something like that, which is why it's a big deal. This is not, the 43rd congressman from California going over to look at some semiconductor plant. So on the one hand, sure, yeah, I mean, the Taiwanese can support it or not. But the question is, and the real reason that I oppose it is, we have so much going on right now. The U.S.-China relationship is so complicated right now. There was no reason for this visit. It just unnecessarily makes things even worse across the range of issues the U.S. and China have to deal with. It's not like China did anything, so we had to respond, or Taiwan did anything. She did it on her own, and that's caused us to spend all this time when we don't have to, and it's making it worse. So no, I don't think she should have done it.
Why do you think she did it?
I have no idea. And what's interesting, she published that op-ed in the Washington Post about democracies, which was a little odd given that she just went to Singapore, right? Which is not the most democratic country in the world, right? So, and that framing is just pure propaganda, right? She's had a history of, she really cares about human rights in China. We all know she went in 1990. My colleague at the U.S.-China Institute here wrote an op-ed about how he was arrested when he was over there and she laid the flowers. So yeah, there's reasons why she cares about democracy and human rights. But again, as a politician or as a diplomat, was this the time to go? And I'm not sure it was. The status quo was working pretty well.
Is there ever a time to go? Given, I can't point to the time since Newt Gingrich visited when I would say, yes, we should send the vice president there.
Yeah, I think that the timing was more provocative than usual, simply because the 20th Party Congress, which is a twice a decade leadership reshuffle, is happening this October or November. Xi Jinping is widely expected to take a third term as Communist Party leader, which defies recent precedents. So there's a kind of pressure to have everything working well, to have stability leading into this kind of political coronation for Xi Jinping. So there's a particular need to defend his nationalist credentials and to at least have a strong show of force, which is what's happening right now. We're seeing unprecedented military drills and missile tests in the waters around Taiwan. That said, Xi Jinping still enjoys a very dominant position in the Chinese political system. So I think some of the commentary out there that suggests that, you know, this is putting Xi under a huge amount of pressure and that he has to do something extreme to defend himself from attacks is a bit off base, because Xi's already in a strong position. So for him, the imperative is to is for stability and to avoid anything going drastically wrong, which starting a military confrontation or conflict would potentially do, given how unpredictable it would be. So the timing is a little bit sensitive, more sensitive than usual right now. But that said, I mean, yeah, there's, from China's perspective, there's never a good time. And I think the previous congressional delegations and Pelosi's trips shows that there's, you know, only a limited appetite for starting something really serious from a military perspective now. Although the more that the U.S. keeps doing this and potentially pressing towards China's red lines, the more likely it is that Beijing feels that it needs to escalate its military responses.
Well, you brought up the idea of risk a couple times. Okay, I think I'm hearing both of you say that it, well, there's a slight difference. Kang says wasn't quite worth the risk, and Thomas says wasn't a huge risk, but not sure it was worth it. But what about the rewards? Articulate for me either what she thought the rewards could be, or, and if you agree with her, what you think the rewards might be, maybe even in an abstract sense.
I think in terms of why Pelosi's going, I think we have to look at her kind of personal political career. She's the House Speaker, but Democrats are probably going to lose the House in the midterms. So that's effectively the end of her career, likely, as she's 82 years old, as a senior leader in U.S. politics. So she wants to have a capstone to that career and really make a statement about her support for human rights and democracy in Asia and her, you know, opposition to the Communist Party. So I think in terms of the timing, from Pelosi's point of view, that's a big reason why she's going now. And, you know, also there's the backdrop of, you know, increasing tensions across the Strait, Beijing's more assertive diplomacy, so, you know, to show a support for Taiwan. So I think that's the reward she saw in it. And I think that's also the reward that Taiwan sees, or at least, you know, there's obviously differences of opinion in Taiwan itself, but the current government, which is more anti-mainland than the opposition, if you like, which is not necessarily pro-unification, but it's more friendly to the mainland, supported this because I think they see having these gestures of support as something that can signal to Beijing that Taiwan has powerful friends and that there are huge risks of the U.S. getting involved if Beijing were to attempt any type of invasion or escalation in the Taiwan Straits. And there's also a domestic political angle in Taiwan. This is a political win for the governing DPP, you know, showing the support, getting a high-level visit, and that could help them in the midterm elections that are coming up in November in Taiwan as well as in the U.S.
Okay, so I'm a staffer, let's say chief of staff for Nancy Pelosi, and I give a call to Professor Kang at USC, a little bit further away from me than San Francisco, an esteemed expert. And I'm like, Dave, she wants to go. She says to me, what's the point of being Speaker of the House if I can't do these things and I'm not going to be Speaker of the House forever? What should I tell her? What would you say to him?
Well, again, I mean, from her perspective, I think Neil's put it right. I mean, there's, again, she's got this personal commitment. She's a politician, et cetera, right? What I think is surprising, and what was really surprising, you know, she announced it back in April, then didn't go for a bunch of reasons. But there's been no discussion of this. Usually when you go, there's a long buildup. Everybody announces it. They talk about it. Biden kept quiet. It's really mystifying as to what was going on.
Well, I would, if I could guess, I think it's probably a better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission type decision.
Which is why this is such an interesting or a fraught issue, because it's clearly not a administration national policy to go. And she's going on and on. She's flying solo, whatever. You know, you're off the blah, 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 right? Like, it's confusing. So I would say be clear about why you're going and what you hope to gain, because I'm not sure anybody gained that much other than we are inching closer, as Neil said, towards what I think is a very dangerous American policy of abandoning the sort of one, you know, the 4 decades of established American policy. And I think that would be really dangerous for it to do.
Okay, so her going might screw our courage to the sticking point a little bit.
It's a step in that direction. Absolutely.
Well, then, it might have, you know, if you only talk about your commitments, that's one thing. If you do something to more forcefully demonstrate your commitments, then your commitments become a bit more committed, right?
But that is exactly the question, is what is our commitment to Taiwan? And one of the points that for the last 5 months, I've been asked, what does China learn from the Russia, you know, from Ukraine? And I say, I'm not sure it's China that should learn something. I think maybe Taiwan ought to learn something, which is, to me, the U.S. is very careful about getting in a war with a nuclear-armed superpower. That's the blessing. You know, so what are our commitments? That's the question. We have left them purposefully vague so that we don't lock ourselves in.
And do you think that Taiwan would look at the United States' reaction, which was an arm's length support and giving 12 HIMAR missile systems, but not the 20 or 30 they want, and be heartened and encouraged, or be more worried?
I've been going to Taiwan for, 25 years and stuff, right? And what has been clear is that usually the U.S. is the one egging on Taiwan to buy high-powered weapons, and Taiwan is usually reluctant to do so, right? I'm not sure that Taiwan sees a military solution to their relationship with China, right? They don't have to invade, like, Normandy on D-Day, right? But, the risks of military action are tremendous for the Taiwanese. And so I think that's one component, but I don't think they first start with, we're going to have a war against China and we're going to win. And that's, I think, the danger that the Americans are, is that we view it all in that lens. But I think there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, I think the Ukraine crisis and Russia's invasion is a lesson that's still being learned, in the sense that the situation is not over. Like, we don't yet necessarily have a set of clear takeaways from a discrete event. Like, things are still happening that are being watched very closely, both in China and in Taiwan. You could see that Beijing taking a lesson that this is really difficult to try and, you know, take over territory from a people that don't want you there and that have, you know, great and powerful friends. We saw the reaction from the West in terms of, you know, military support, but especially economic sanctions directed at Russia being, you know, far more extreme and, you know, I think still far more sustained than people were expecting would be possible beforehand, in terms of moving away from Russian energy and incurring costs to punish Russia. So there's certainly a precedent there that suggests to Beijing right now that, you know, escalating tensions in a really dangerous way, you know, unlike we've seen so far, could be extremely costly. And China, still, Xi is a bit more constrained by the institutions of the Communist Party and the expectations of the Chinese people for continued economic growth than Putin is, who's basically, economic growth is no longer a key goal of the Russian state, but still is, very much so for the Communist Party.
Right, not widespread, at least. Economic growth for his, 20 oligarchs maybe is too a bit.
Yeah, having enough money to, keep the military going and keep the security services supporting his personal rule. Russia's economy has been a disaster for the Russian people since 2014 and the invasion of Crimea. But I think the thing I was going to say is that this Western response is still developing. So if we saw diminution of Western pressure on Russia, or the sanctions regime falling apart because countries just abandon it because it's too costly, then that could change how Beijing thinks about Taiwan, and potentially the costs of doing anything would be lower than previously thought. So I think that's, from the Chinese point of view as well as from the Taiwanese point of view, there's lessons being learned from how this situation evolves in Ukraine.
All right, we're going to take a break for a quick second. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the lessons of Hong Kong. And if this trip by Speaker Pelosi didn't cause a war, what might? Talk to you in a minute. The This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're back speaking with Neil Thomas and David Kang. Question for you. So if we acknowledge, or as both of you gentlemen have said, unlikely that this would start a war, and it seems not to have, what might start a war? What might be the signals or the developments that prompt China to invade, or as they would see it, engage in a reclamation project?
They do these live fire exercises. They do, they send planes through the ADIZ, the air defense identification zone of Taiwan. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, the biggest clue that we have is the Chinese have made very, very clear that if Taiwan declares formal independence, they will use force. So that would be the biggest clue to me that they're going to do it. And I believe them, and most of us do. Right, that this is, they're not fooling around, and they're doing everything they can. And they talk very differently about Taiwan than they do about South China Seas, where they say, let's work it out, let's not use force. They say, we will use force if you declare public independence. And so that would be the biggest clue to me. There's also wording they use, and I think Neil knows better than I do, but they said, like before Vietnam in 79 and India in 62, they said, don't say you haven't been warned. I mean, it's very much more rhetoric than they were using now. The kind of rhetoric they use now about we're prepared to fight, they say all the time, right? But there are some very clear things they almost never say, which to me would be like, uh-oh, time to start taking it seriously.
Yeah, we'd also see on the military side a build-up across from the Taiwan Strait beyond, you know, normal exercises. So in the same way that the Biden administration was warning about Russia's potential invasion of Ukraine for many months before it happened, we'd be getting similar clues from satellite intelligence about Chinese military movements if, you know, a full-scale invasion was in the offing. In terms of other things to watch in terms of warning signals, I think the Chinese Communist Party's official position on Taiwan are really important watch points, especially, you know, what's said at this 20th Party Congress later this year. So currently the line from the Communist Party, which is, you know, it's meaningful because this is the instructions that it sends to its millions of cadres and public servants and its 95 plus million members. So what they say is meaningful in that sense. And they're currently saying that, you know, time and momentum are always on our side when it comes to the unification of the motherland, to use Beijing's terminology. And that suggests that Beijing is not looking in to rush this reunification. It's trying to still achieve its stated objective of peaceful unification. That's clearly a reason why they'd prefer that. Not going to war is far cheaper. It's far less dangerous for China's economy and international reputation. It's also far less risky for the Chinese leader at the time, because if you launched an invasion and it didn't go right, or you failed, or it became a kind of Vietnam-type quagmire, then that could seriously undermine Xi Jinping himself. So you'd have to be really sure that you'd be able to pull it off. So at the moment, it seems the party is still, you know, trying to build its advantage in terms of its military power, its economic position, its political sway to, you know, eventually, you know, force or potentially coerce some type of peaceful unification without war in the future.
So undergirding that point is an assumption that I recognize in the West, which is we believe that China will act in their rational self-interest, as we think we understand it. When it comes to other nuclear states, that's less true. North Korea, Kim Jong-un is certainly seen as more of a live wire, and Putin upended our expectations in that mostly now we said, well, that was a surprise. I don't think that was in his self-interest to invade Ukraine, although after the fact, we're beginning to understand why it might have been. But here is my question concern, and it's something you've been both been noting, but I read an article that you wrote, Neil, about it. The Wolf Warriors, these diplomats who are saying things that aren't exactly in line with the caution of the Communist Party. And I wonder, are they lone wolf warriors? Are they loose cannons? Should we worry more about a really aggressive, nationalistic, off-the-reservation, off-script component in China's foreign policy? And might that change what their own perception is in terms of rational self-interest?
Well, I'd say that the Wolf Warriors are very much acting in line with what Xi Jinping wants from China's diplomats. There's not really such thing as freelancing in the Communist Party system. You can certainly try and push the boundaries and take some risks under current direction. And that's perhaps how some of this more bellicose rhetoric got started. But the fact it's continuing indicates that it's something that the party wants to keep happening. And we've seen, you know, language from Xi himself that you know, China should more assertively defend its interests in the world. So I think we have to differentiate what we might think the rational, self-interested way for China to act would be, which would not include having a territorial claim over Taiwan, from what Beijing, at least the Communist Party, considers to be its own self-interest. And from their point of view, unifying with Taiwan, which they believe is Chinese territory and they should have sovereignty to, that's in their interest. So they're going to move the system and try and, you know, achieve that goal. But they're not totally unhinged about the risks of moving against Taiwan. I mean, they've wanted to take Taiwan ever since the Communist Party established the People's Republic in 1949. But, you know, 73 years later, there hasn't really been a significant, you know, action to actually reclaim sovereignty. So that suggests there's, you know, obviously a pragmatic consideration to some degree about, can we do this? And China's certainly more capable than ever before of doing that. But there's still at least some level of awareness that this would be very difficult, very costly, and would, you know, fundamentally alter China's relationship with the world.
I have two thoughts that I say about Taiwan all the time, which is this isn't a PRC concern. When you talk about what's rational, we can go back to 1895, where the Qing dynasty said, if Japan takes Taiwan from us, it will be a permanent, we will be enemies forever, etc. This is transdynastic in a way, right? It's not that no one cared about Taiwan before. They explicitly, this was Chinese territory, so to speak, right? And historically, we always talk, oh, it wasn't blah, blah, blah. The people, the indigenous peoples on Taiwan 200 years ago, whatever, never formed their own government, kingdom, and engaged in tribute relations with China or Korea or Japan. The UQs did. Okinawa was conquered. It had formal diplomatic status in pre-modern Asia. Taiwan never did, right? So I don't want to quibble about it, but this has been an enduring Chinese concern. So when you saw, like, as Neil said, is it rational? Yes, for them. This is not, oh, who cares? This is part of Chinese territory. The Hong Kong was, etc., right? That was taken over the last 100 years or so. I think time is on China's side in this, right? The move to from containing Taiwan and pressuring them to opening the doors to the economy and allowing Taiwanese to come back has been spectacularly successful on the Chinese side. Trade, investment, travel. It was the Taiwanese government that was trying to limit cross-strait relations because they knew what would happen, right? So I think if the Chinese have a long-term view, they're like, you know, this is going in our direction. And I would contrast that with North and South Korea, where there's been no change over the last 75 years or whatever, right? So, you know, I'm not so sure that they view it as necessarily all negative. I think it's a lot more complicated.
Time's on their side. Do they really say we think in centuries, or is that just something we think they say?
Well, they did wait, 100 years to get Hong Kong back, right? And that's what I mean. It's like, if you look at it this way, and they say you can do whatever you want, just don't declare formal independence. The status quo is working pretty well.
Yeah. To me, Hong Kong hangs over this in a huge way. It's a tragedy. It's heartbreaking. I think in America, it's a thing that happened. And since we didn't have any troops there, we didn't pay much attention. But there were 8 million free people in the world, Western-facing democracy, and now there aren't. And I don't know if we or any of the other world superpowers could have done anything about it, but we didn't do anything, and Hong Kong fell, essentially. And I was wondering if there's an argument for some sort of more forceful intervention in Taiwan just so we don't let Hong Kong happen again. Or am I making a bad analogy?
I think that the point about Hong Kong very usefully highlights some differences with the Taiwan situation. So Hong Kong, despite being a special administrative region, has been recognized as sovereign Chinese territory, at least under the agreements that were signed before its handover since 1997. China's obviously violated some of those agreements that it made with the British, the Sino-British Joint Treaty. And what's happened in Hong Kong is, as you said, a tragedy for democracy and human rights. Taiwan, though, is not under any type of formal Chinese jurisdiction, and it's also much more difficult to use military to kind of intimidate or attack. There's a huge strait in between it rather than just a land border. So there's logistical difficulties there. But I think that it also takes us back to the first part of our conversation about what's the most effective things the U.S. and its leaders to be doing to help protect Taiwan. And I agree that the Pelosi trip might be symbolically important, but it doesn't do a lot to change the kind of hard power calculus between China, Taiwan, the United States, and its allies. So I think that, the priority should be for the U.S. to, invest in military deterrence and to ensure that, Taiwan and its allies in the region is prepared to, invest in security in the Indo-Pacific and to make any type of Chinese escalation or invasion as costly and unlikely as possible.
I think that's right. I think, where we are right now is a situation where I would like to see the American policymaking establishment maybe think a little more closely about the risks and benefits of egging Taiwan on and pushing them forward to make a decision that we may not be ready to support them on. But in general, I think that the situation isn't nearly as dangerous as we've been sort of seeing in the foreign policymaking press. All three sides still have a pretty clear understanding of what each other wants and what each other expects. And so I don't see that having been unalterably changed by Pelosi's trip.
The last voice you heard was David King, professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. And we were also joined by Neil Thomas, the senior China analyst for the Eurasia Group. Gentlemen, thank you both so very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for today's show. Assistant producer Corey Warr is not covered by Alex Jones's Hell Fired. He just fired up about coverage of the Alex Jones trial. Senior producer Joel Patterson does not believe that you, the audience, to be more than 7 or 8% lizard people. The thing about Peachfish Production COO Michelle Pesca is she's not in the fire or of the fire. She's more like lighting a fire under all of us to properly adhere to HR protocols. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo, gperoo, dooperoo, and thanks for listening.